This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends. It's your boy, Michael Cruz Kane, back again with another episode of, you know it, A Good Cry, this time with Atsuko Okatsuka, who, if she's not one of your favorite comedians already, she soon will be. Check out her late night sets. Check out her HBO special, obviously. Her TikTok with her grandmother and her husband. See her live. Do whatever you can to get in front of Atsuko. She is one of the most interesting, funny, brilliant comedians out there. And the thing that separates her, I think, from a lot of people is that she approaches things from an angle that I myself rarely ever consider. So I'm always excited to see what her perspective will be on anything at all. We talk about a different kind of grief on this episode than we normally do. Usually we're focused on the grief that surrounds a death, but in this case, we're talking about Atsuko's mother, who has schizophrenia, and the ramifications of that diagnosis and the complications that come with it. We also talk about what it was like for her to come to this country, that experience, and the absolutely beautiful coincidence that her husband's mother also has schizophrenia. This is a great episode. Atsuko, who is brilliant in all realms, is also brilliant here. I hope you enjoy it. A Good Cry with Atsuko Okatsuka. Atsuko, the way that we start the podcast is by asking the question, how would you describe your relationship to grief?
Mm-hmm. How would I describe my relationship to grief? I would say it's kind of a stranger. We're strangers.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
I think I sort of keep a distance from it, you know, and I don't know how well I do being in it. So maybe I try to avoid it as much as possible.
I would say that is a very normal response to grief.
Some people run to it. They love it.
I guess that's true. I wouldn't say that I run to it, but I think having experienced it a lot, I think I kind of like, oh, here it comes. I kind of like sit there. Mm-hmm. It's like turbulence on a plane. It's like, this is going to happen. I can't not have it for me.
Yeah, no, that's a very self-aware person speaking, you know.
Only in one tiny way, and that's it.
No, that's a huge ability. Huge. It's a huge milestone. It's a great place to be, honestly. And, you know, I was joking that some people like to run to it, but I had an ex that was like super self-proclaimed emo, you know, and so he loved being in grief.
I didn't even know that emo was a thing that people called them. I thought that was inherently a derogatory term. Am I wrong about that? That's like people, I just assumed that was an insult.
Oh, yeah. No, people prided. I mean, maybe, I don't know. I don't know if it was a Southern California thing, because I can only talk about my experience. But, you know, when I moved out of my mom and grandma's place and, you know, ran off to Santa Clarita, which they shot things like Santa Clarita Diet.
If you've seen,
it's like the suburbs. That's where I ran off to move in with my boyfriend at the time. And he was like self-proclaimed emo. He would drink like Jack Daniels, you know, even though he was a teenager and loved like Nightmare Before Christmas and stuff before it was cool, you know, that kind of stuff. But also be sad and kind of love it.
Nightmare Before Christmas, that and emo, those things I put together. Jack Daniels to me feels like a different... Mm-hmm. Like I, in my mind, an emo kid drinks like wine, but I don't know what it is for real. So
no, yeah, that's why That's why it was a real thing where I was like, oh, I think you actually need to see somebody, because it wasn't just like, it wasn't just like a cool emo phase. You know what I mean? Like actual, I was like, oh, this is actually a problem, not a cute name you gave yourself. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Okay, wait. I have derailed this so
close. Oh, really?
To the
okay, no, I did, because I brought up a former lover. I was just trying to show off. Like, I have exes.
I got. Oh, yeah. The other podcast that we do is Tons of Lovers. That's Asuka's podcast. So, just for the listeners of this podcast, your grief is new on the podcast because we're talking about your mother, who is alive.
Yes, my mom is alive. That's right. And you said
correct.
You said most people come on and talk about not alive folk.
I would say predominantly this podcast is dominated by discussions about the non-alive.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
But your mother is schizophrenic. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. My mom has paranoid schizophrenia. And because of that, she also has sort of other things too that she's developed over the years, you know, like OCD, just from like paranoias and then so needing control, you know. And so she has like OCD and physical stuff that's come up because, you know, of her paranoias. Like she won't, like my mom hasn't showered in 20 years, for example. Like she hasn't bathed in 20 years. And so there's physical ailments from that. And yeah, so she has a number of things. She probably has depression too. We just haven't been able to bring her in to really check on that. And she also gets seizures. Yeah. So paranoid schizophrenia is like one of the things she has. But because of it, there's a bunch of other stuff going on. I think it's just like things that can develop, because if you hear voices all the time and you're hallucinating and your state of paranoia is at an all-time high, right, with schizophrenia. And sometimes people with schizophrenia also get seizures. And my mom gets seizures like 3-4 times a week. And so with all of that, right, what's going to happen? You're going to get depressed. It's just sort of this like, not that schizophrenia causes depression. It's just, it can because of the circumstance that you're given.
The way I understand what you're saying is like, imagine if you had to go through what a schizophrenic person goes through, you would probably get depressed.
Right. So then she has a hard time getting up out of bed. It's hard for her to get motivated to want to do anything, you know, be in a state of constant sadness. And so, boom, there is depression. And yeah. And then the OCD is to try to, I think, you know, have a sense of control. So she has to wash her hands for over a minute every time, just with water, though, because soap she's afraid of. You know, there's a paranoia with soap. So, you know, stuff like that. Like, you know, I have to count to a minute every time I wash my hands, only my hands, or, you know, stuff like that. I have to, when I hang up the phone, I have to click the end button 5 times. You know, she does stuff like that. But I think that's just a way of her trying to be like, I have some control in my life, you know?
Yeah, sure. That makes sense to me as much as it can. You know, I mean, like, obviously I don't have the experience, but I understand what you're saying. When did your mother start to exhibit these symptoms?
So supposedly she started showing signs of it. I mean, it's hard because, you know, there's a lot of communities that don't believe in mental illness, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Like, my mom is part of my Taiwanese side of the family. And that side, like, believes in ghosts and stuff. That culture, Taiwanese culture, believes in ghosts and, like, you know, ancestors and praying to them and stuff. But, you know, depression is a myth. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think like my mom's family's Filipina. Uh-huh. And we have, like, she has a brother who had issues that remain undiagnosed, but it was sort of like the POV of him was like, oh, you're fucked up. And not like, yeah, let's try and find, like, you know, doctors, et cetera, and, like, you know, support for you. It was more like, you have a problem.
Right.
Stop having it. The treatment was, don't be like this anymore. And of course, that treatment didn't work.
Right. Where it's like, oh, yeah, Linda, she's the weird one. You know, she's a weird one. She, you know, for my grandma, a lot of them always try to treat it with food. So for a long time growing up, they're like, your mom, you know, she has low blood sugar. Oh, she's just hungry. Oh, she's thirsty again. Gotta get her hydrated stat. You know what I mean? So we were always feeding her. Anytime, you know, she seemed like she was going to throw a temper tantrum because the voices in her head were going wild or whatever. You know what I mean? You're like, oh, she's hungry again. You know, so it's just wild to grow up thinking your mom was hungry and thirsty all the time, only to realize, right, like, it's just schizophrenia, you know?
Was it was she saying things like, I'm hearing voices? Like, was she articulating the issues she was having as you remember it? Or was it just like she would start acting like super angry or something?
Yeah. I mean, as a kid, it was mostly the paranoias. When she was younger and her mind was sharper, she was able to try to compartmentalize the voices away from reality so that I wouldn't be as affected. But does that make sense? So the voices were happening in her head.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Right, but she would just outwardly tell me the paranoias that came from it. So like, you know, the Taiwanese spies are here. You know, they're here, so lock the doors. Don't talk anything about politics. Just only speak in Japanese. Only speak in Japanese. You know, stuff like that, like growing up. And when you grow up like that, you just think that's like your mom, you know? I didn't have a super easy time making friends, so it wasn't like I spent a ton of time with other people's moms either. I grew up watching Disney movies, and none of the princesses have moms. So I just thought,
there are no moms in Disney movies. It's so weird.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's not like I had moms in the media that I could really sort of like refer to as. I didn't think my mom was that abnormal. I know she didn't make me feel great, you know, and she scared me. But I think this is still trying to answer your question of like, when did we start seeing signs? But it's like all of this was maybe my reality. So I didn't think, and I didn't even know what a psychiatrist or what mental health even was. You know, as a kid.
Yeah, so, sure. Why would you?
I just thought she was hungry. And you know what I mean? So, but all those things in retrospect, all those things, she was already going through it, you know, ever since probably I was a baby.
And you said you were you in Japan at that time?
Yeah, I was in Japan at that time.
But your mother is Taiwanese, right?
Yeah. So my mother's side is Taiwanese. My dad's side is Japanese. And they were already divorced when we were living in Japan together. There's a ton of things that I think go into, you know, her mental health and the things that were, I think, you know, the paranoias came from living in Japan, which is a very xenophobic place to live. You know, they're actually very like about Japan, if you can recall from history at all. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, of course. And then also like my political history of Taiwan knowledge is very limited.
Okay.
But there is like political drama that persists to this day in Taiwan, right? Like the idea of spies in Taiwan, is that totally an outlandish concept? Or could that be like a real thing not happening to you in Japan necessarily, but a real thing that was happening in Taiwan?
For
like
sure,
when she
yeah.
was a kid maybe? Yeah.
Yeah, my mom's father, my grandpa, was murdered when she was like 8 years old. And his father was involved in politics in this small town that they lived in. And like the elections were happening and my grandpa's father was running for his sort of seat in the elections. And they're of the party that wants Taiwan to be independent. And, you know, for democracy, for Taiwan to be independent, not go back to being a part of China. So that's my family's party. And the other party, Kuomintang, which is the blue party. I'm sorry to get into politics about Taiwan.
No, I brought it up.
But
I want to know.
So the blue party kind of ruled for a long, long time. Right now, the president is the green party, the one my grandpa, my great grandpa, my grandma are a part of. You know, the one that wants independence for Taiwan. She also did really badass things like, you know, legalized gay marriage in Taiwan, like the only Asian country to do that. She's like the first female president in like an Asian country too. She's doing really badass things. And, you know, I'm kind of proud because like that's the party that my grandpa, if he were still alive, would have still voted for and, you know, been a part of. But so the other party, to stop his father from running in the elections, decided to teach him a lesson and killed the son instead. My grandma's husband, my grandpa, my mother's father. And she was 8 years old when, like, his body was brought back and everything. And because there's politics in that, I think that's why, like, the Taiwanese spies, you know, they want us to go back to China, that whole thing, watching what's happening with Ukraine, you know, and Russia. You know, for people who don't know the Taiwan politics as much and why people are so scared of what might happen for Taiwan is because, like, what's happening to Ukraine could happen to Taiwan with China, like a bigger country claiming a smaller one as theirs. Does that make sense?
Right. So it's not. So, yeah, I mean, listening to this, it's like it's not just your mom's whatever sort of chemical things are happening to her that are giving her the difficulty that she's having. It's also truly like profound trauma.
Yeah. And based on truth, is what I always like. Folks with schizophrenia, like, I think it always seems like it's so hard to understand. It feels like otherworldly, you know, but I'm constantly surprised by how much my mom's been the truth teller of so many things from the beginning. And we just always, you know, like, brushed it off like, ah, she's weird. You know what I mean?
What's an example of that? What do you mean by that? Her being a truth teller?
While we were going to church, you know, when we first came to the States, you know, that's the church, usually that's how they get immigrants, right? It's like, we need new friends and new communities, so you join the church.
Yeah, so you're looking for like a place to assimilate.
Right.
Like it makes sense to go to a church.
Yeah, and so my uncle and aunt who let us stay at their place when we moved here, they were part of the church. And so our whole entire family went, except for my mom. And my mom refused to go. And she just talked about the hypocrisies of a place like the church, you know, and how we have to be careful because there's a lot of like morality stuff that they preach. But, you know, it's really, we're all just still just human beings at the end of the day. And they're going to hurt you one day, you know, because it's easy to just preach like, you know, be good people, you know, because you want to go to this place called heaven, whatever. And we would always like be like, she's weird. She's going to hell or whatever, you know. And then years later, now I don't, you know, I stopped going to church like in the ninth grade. And then I had a moment where I was like, oh yeah, my mom was so right. You know, where I would see like every after sermon, right, they would serve lunch at the church. And I remember on multiple occasions, like unhoused folks would show up wanting some lunch and they would get turned away because they didn't come to the sermon, you know. Stuff like that that my mom always said would happen. And I finally saw it happen to, you know, this Taiwan-China relation thing. You know, she'd always say, God, it's going to happen soon. You know, they're going to make it to the States. I'm sure of it. And then, you know, as a kid, sorry, again, this is Taiwan politics. It's very specific. But she would say, that politics is going to make it to the United States too soon. Watch. The party that wants Taiwan to be a back with China is going to show up in the States too. And just a few months ago, I don't know if you saw, but at a Taiwanese church, there was a mass shooting where it was somebody who wants Taiwan to be a part of China. It was like that same thing. And, you know, not to say like my mom is a witch or a, you know what I mean? Or a fortune teller.
Right. She's not like a soothsayer.
Yeah, it's just, you know, she hyper-focuses on things because of the paranoias, and they're still based on truths.
And there's so much, like, you're talking about, so there's the trauma of her childhood, but also, like, as you said, being Taiwanese in Japan had to be difficult in a lot of ways. I think that's a thing also for a lot of listeners of this podcast who were like, well, Asia's just kind of one big place where all the Asians are, not realizing that there's like these granular differences between the bajillion cultures that exist in Asia.
Right.
And how difficult it can be to like move among them. And you probably felt some version of that. I mean, it's more stark because like you're not white, but when you move to the States, to be transplanted is also difficult.
Yeah. From place to place like that. But, you know, in Japan, it was maybe extra confusing because it's like, well, we look like each other, you know, we all look like right. each other. Why would you treat us differently? And it's like,
Did you speak Japanese fluently when you moved to like, is it the kind of situation where like you would open your mouth and someone would be like, oh, you're not Japanese?
That wasn't happening to me. It was happening to my mom.
Right.
You know, because my mom's the one that moved there as an adult, married a Japanese man, had to pick up the language, but she had an accent and she's not Japanese and she wasn't working. She didn't have any friends there. She married a man with kids already. She had to suddenly be a stepmom. But I have a feeling if she was already displaying signs of schizophrenia and she was already having seizures ever since she was like 14, you know, she really felt like a freak, you know? And so all of that didn't help, you know, fish out of water, super fish out of water.
For like Atsuko, who's so little at this time living in Japan, how does that make you feel? Like when you come to the realization that your mother is not the same as other mothers, what do you remember how it felt to learn that?
Yeah, I think so. Because the couple of friends that I did hang out with, and when I would go to their place, you know, dinner would be cooked by the mom and then we would sit together. The dad would come home from work. It's a very patriarchal society there. So the father would come home from work. Dinner is ready, you know, and then we all sit down. And the mom's really nice, and she helped us with our homework. And then we'd do the dishes as, like, we would watch a little TV with the father, you know. And then I would walk home to my place, which was always different. You know, where, you know, in Japan, like, divorce was already looked down upon. So there was that, too. They're just a very traditional society. So, like, when there would be, like, parent-teacher conferences or we would do, like, recitals for the parents and stuff, my family was always the unconventional-looking one, you know, where it was my Taiwanese grandma and Taiwanese mom that was there, or just my dad sometimes. Everyone always had both their parents there, and they were full-blooded Japanese. You know what I mean? And as God intended. And man and wife, full Japanese as God intended. And and my family wasn't. And, you know, so there were things like that, or there were Japanese TV shows. I also got into, like, watching Full House, you know. But that maybe I liked it because it was also an unconventional family where it was.
That's
like,
a very unconventional family. Isn't that like all the moms are dead or something in that family?
Yeah,
right?
Again, all the moms are dead. Again, all the moms are dead. And so maybe that's not a good example, but maybe that's why I kept watching these shows where the moms were dead. And I don't know. I mean, I guess I would have to talk to a therapist about why that is and why that was comforting to me, that there was no mother figure and that the people on the TV shows and the movies seemed to still thrive and get by fine without a normal mother around, you know? Snow White ended up marrying a hot prince, you know, and so did Little Mermaid, and so did Belle from Beauty and the Beast. You know, all those people didn't have moms. Pocahontas too. She and her grandmother was a fucking tree. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound necessarily like you may have been seeking out those kind of stories, but also like that's like you just named like five Disney movies in a row. Like that's what they were making. I mean, it's like the cultural touchstones were all strangely motherless. Like, I don't know. There's surely a great New Yorker article to be written on this subject if it hasn't been written yet.
For sure. Yeah. Sorry. I'm coughing.
That's okay.
Got like a piece of dust in there while you were saying such a nice, profound thing about the New Yorker. They should do an article. They should. I'm sure it's been written about. I think Walt Disney had issues with his mother or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it does not seem at all unlikely. That was a deeply fucked up dude, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, like Mother's Day would come around and stuff. And there were moments, especially later on, that I sometimes would get mad that I didn't have a quote-unquote normal mom, you know. And then I think the anger would, ultimately, the basis was sadness, you know, because I felt bad for feeling that way. I felt bad for my mom, you know, and then I wouldn't feel so bad for me. It was more just the situation that I would feel sad about, you know?
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. I think like thinking back to like my family, I think in some of those situations, there's also like an element of shame when the mental illness part of it is not an accepted part culturally, that it's like my family was kind of embarrassed of my uncle. And then like, you know, there's also homosexuality was also like really frowned upon still. And there was also shame about that. So a lot of the stuff was just like kept secret. Like, you know, it is a very successful family, but a lot of like personal details are hidden. Does that feel true to you? Is that something like, were you ever ashamed? Like, was it ever a thing where like kids would want to come over and you'd be like, I don't want, like, you know, don't come over because I don't know what's going to happen with my mom?
Yeah, I would start, you know, when I first moved to the States, I started going over to one neighbor's house a lot, and I would just eat dinner there and not have dinner with my mom and grandma anymore for periods of time like that. And that family would sort of be my new family, you know. And in retrospect, it's really sad because they didn't see me a lot during that time, like fifth grade and sixth grade. I would always go over because they literally lived like a 2-minute walk away. And there's also another layer of the shame of having friends over is that like we lived in a garage. We lived in my uncle's garage because we were also undocumented when we first moved here. And we didn't have any money. My uncle was nice enough to let us stay in his property. He's like, I have this garage, you can stay there. So we lived there too. So that was also not like...
So you, your mother, and your grandmother were living in your uncle's garage and you were undocumented. At that time, was the undocumentedness of it something that was scary to you or just like...
I didn't know I was undocumented until I was like 17 when I wanted to start driving. And then they were like, oh, you can't because you don't have a social security number. And I was like, what's that? Because, you know, again, like I don't study
right,
law.
Why would you need to know that?
I'm a preteen. I just thought we got on a plane. When you get on a plane, you land somewhere, like you were allowed to do that. Or when you just land somewhere, you're allowed to do that. Like, because I don't know immigration
law. This is where I am.
Law.
I'm here now.
Yeah. Like whoever's physically wherever... they're allowed to be there, right? And that's why I think children should run for office, because I think that's a profound idea.
Because that makes sense.
Wherever the fuck you are, you're allowed to be. Why not? Who made the rules anyway? Other weirdos that, you know what I mean, can barely like stand on their own? Humans? Other humans? Have you seen humans? Like we make poor choices historically. And so, of course, I didn't know these immigration laws, you know, I didn't know what undocumented even meant. But, you know, in retrospect, like, I think sort of the environment, the feels of it was sort of weighing on me. And the physical look of a garage isn't that cool if you're trying to make friends, especially, you know what I mean? If you're like trying to impress a crush. You know, oh,
right. You're not like, let me take you back to this garage. Oh, but it gets better. My mom and grandma are also in there.
Yeah. Do you mind if they watch us play? Because this is, oh, sorry. They have to, because the living room and the bedroom and the kitchen, we're always in the same room.
That's one room.
This is where I do my homework. This is where they say, don't shit where you
eat. Don't shit where you eat.
Yeah.
Don't shit where you eat.
Well, you've never fucking lived in a garage, have you? So, maybe that's why I like these Disney princess stories too, because they always start out like impossibly sad. Like, what the fuck? Like, really? They call you Cinderella, like because you know what I mean? And you scrub and stuff. And like you talk to mice and you live with mice, you know what I mean? And I guess in a weird way, like if someone were to look into our lives, they would probably be like, oh my God, like this is made up. Like,
This is
just like, you know, have you seen Joy Luck Club? There's moments where it's like so tragically sad.
Yeah. I haven't seen it for a long time. I read the book in high school too.
But it's like, oh, come on, for real? Like, heroin overdose and she drowns her baby. You know what I mean? Like, oh, you're making that up. You know what I mean? It's like the Old Testament or something. Like, oh, really? No, you're just, it's made up. You know what I mean? That I think that's sometimes what my childhood feels like it sounds like. And so I don't, and I'm not sad about it. I'm not. Like, that was just that, you know, I'm who I am today because of it. But yeah, so I just only said the garage part because you asked if, you know, I would try to hide it. That if there was shame around my mom, there was, but also our living situation.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
As you've gotten older, how has your perspective on your mom changed? Like, it seemed like when you were super young, it was like, I don't even know any different. Moms are like this.
But I was scared of her. I was scared of her and I wouldn't get close to her. Yeah, I wouldn't open up to her. I was scared to talk to her. I was scared to physically even touch her because she would sometimes throw things because she was having hallucinations and really, really upset, you know? So I was scared of her. Now it's turned into a huge empathy. What's the difference between empathy and sympathy? I actually don't know.
I got to tell you, Asko.
Yeah.
I'm going to cut this part out of the podcast because I don't know. This is a question that I've asked 100. One of them is one where you like feel the same thing as the other. I guess that's sympathy. Let's guess. I think sympathy is where you feel the same thing as the other person. Like, you feel sad, I also feel sad. Empathy, I think, is when you understand what the other person is feeling.
Okay, so I have...
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, something bad happens to you, I can see how that would be really terrible, as opposed to we both feel the same sadness about this thing.
Oh, okay, so I have empathy.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Houston?
Yeah, we can have the producers to Google this, please.
Okay, empathy. I'll say that part again. Okay.
I'm just kidding. All this is staying in. All of it.
Oh, good. Okay. I don't know. I mean, I want to make sure you look good, you know?
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, no. Now that I'm older, I it's turned into empathy where I, you know, but now I kind of live in guilt because now we have a better relationship and that I understand where she's coming from. So it's, I don't fear her. I feel more bad about the situation and I feel guilty about it, but we're able to be closer because of it too. Does that make sense?
I don't understand what you mean. You're closer because of the guilt or close because of what?
In a weird way, it's weird that when you fear something, sometimes the immediate band-aid for it is to feel bad for it. Does that make sense? You fear something. So to get over that fear, you try to empathize. And then that can turn into an extreme of feeling bad for it and feeling bad for the person. And it's masked in guilt. And so you sometimes overperform.
It's like you have this fear of her.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you get older and sort of like, well, your like ability to understand things matures, you start to feel bad for her.
Mm-hmm.
And once you start to feel bad for her, there's a guilt that pops up also. That's like, why was I scared? I wish I hadn't been scared of her before. In a way that was like unkind for me to be scared of her.
Yeah. But I still feel guilty today too, because I get to live a normal life relatively and she doesn't. Where in the past, I wasn't even at that kind of awareness of her situation. I was just scared of her more. It's this weird thing. We're able to hang out. I'm able to make her laugh. I know how to help. I know the situation. I've become sort of my own psychiatrist because you know your family the best. You know your loved ones the best. So, you know, I know it's singing a certain song that gets her out of a rut or maybe even make the voices stop coming or getting her to do like a dance with me. When we were able to convince her to paint, my husband would paint with her and that would also make the voices go away temporarily and stuff like that. But it's still not like I get to get super close with her. It's still like, it's still sometimes like it feels like workarounds so that the day is easier for her.
Yeah.
It's not just me being able to like, hey, what's up, mom? So gosh, let me tell you, I did this stand-up show last night and like this one guy was so drunk. I'm still not talking to her like that, like a quote unquote normal mom and kid. You know what I mean? It's still like, good job, mom. That was really good. Okay, we're going to sing another verse, you know? And so maybe that's why I'm figuring it out as I say it out loud because I haven't really tried to put it to words. But it's a different kind of phase in my life with my mom where before I was scared of her, so I wasn't getting to do these experiences with her. But now we're closer together, but is it like real closeness or is it like, am I just being like a nurse? Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, it sounds like what you're saying, you're taking care of her. I mean, like, you know, you go to see her and you don't have the kind of closeness, again, that like, quote unquote, a normal mother-daughter relationship might have, but you have whatever version of it you can have because of her condition, because of the way she thinks.
Yeah. And I think at the bottom of it, there's still all this guilt. You know, I get to do stand-up comedy as a job. Like, what? Are you kidding me? Like, I'm literally clowning off, like being a fool. You know what I mean? I get to do that. You know, I get to like play on Instagram. And
do you think in any way that your artistic expression is a result at all of how you, like, it sounds, what you're describing to me of your childhood and like your relationship with your mother sounds like in many ways, I'm sure rewarding, but also like very stressful and probably not that like goofy. And I, like your stand-up is very fun. Mm-hmm. Like you're such a fun performer. And a lot of stand-ups are not. They're funny, but they're not fun. They're like, you know, it can be kind of excruciating. Like mm-hmm. I think of the, like your performance, even when you're talking about things that are difficult to be like really joyful.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, maybe you've never thought about this before, but do you ever think of that possibly as a result of like, it's a release from caretaking, from like having to be careful of what you say or whatever else?
For sure. Yeah. Or maybe it is a continuation of the caretaking, Michael, because
well, how do you mean?
The way I am with my mom, that's how I am with audiences. Everything's so great.
Oh, really?
Oh my God, isn't it so, okay. Woo, it's so great to be here. Awesome. Okay, all right. So how are you, you know, and stand-up comedy for me is a service. It's we're in the service industry, you know. I don't ever treat it like therapy. I know some comedians do. Sometimes you do have to because something just happened to you and you just have to get it off your chest on stage. I try not to ever treat it that way because I think it's a service. I think they paid to be there. It's an audience. It's a job that you're doing. And so that's what I mean. Maybe it's a continuation of like what I do with my mom. Look over here, mom. Look over here. Okay. All right. Okay. So now we're going to sing this, you know, now I'm going to sing that. Okay. And to finish it off, we're going to paint this thing. That's how I do stand up. I'm making sure you have a better day. Isn't that why I do it? It's why I did it. It's why I got into it, is to make sure other people are having a great time and I can connect with them based on that, you know.
And this question is maybe like so basic.
I'm unwell. So yes, I'm unwell. I'm currently don't have a therapist and I'm taking care of everyone else, like including the way I treat stand-up comedy. It's not so
is
that
it fun?
I can feel better.
Do you
think I do stand-up so that I can feel better? No. I obsessively make sure the jokes are good so that you're having a good time because you paid money to see me.
I can't tell to what degree you are being like completely, totally honest or
I'm being
a little
honest.
Bit joking about.
I'm being honest. It's just sad. That's all. It's that's why you want to maybe think I'm joking.
Well, I guess I think of comedy typically as for many performers of it, so self-serving. So for you to think of it as I've come here to do a service for you. I'm sure other comedians feel that way. I just don't know any of them. I feel like almost every comedian is up there. Most comedians I know are up there and maybe this is some version of this is true for you, just like not on the level you're talking about, but in some way to like, please let me feel better somehow. Like I'm up here so that I can feel better. And hopefully you audience members will recognize this same desperate need to feel better and we can be together.
Oh, of course. That's a big part of it too. Yes, of course. And I feel better when I know that you had fun too. So yes, and I do like that feeling. I want to feel better too. That's why I'm here to make, you know, these jokes that I've worked on really hard and made sure it works, like, you're saying it works, ha 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 ha, great. And then I can ha 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 and go back to sleep. You know what I mean? Like, it is mutual. It is mutual for sure. But, you know, I do think that it is a service job still.
That's really saying that you laugh at these jokes, ha ha ha, and then I go back to sleep is so profound to me that, like how much you believe in it as a service. And I also wonder the jokes that you say you tell to your mom to make her feel better or like to help her kind of work around or silence the voices.
Mm-hmm.
Are those jokes, is that like doing stand-up? Like, do you feel?
No.
You said that somebody's doing stand-up. No, it's not similar at all.
No, I don't do jokes to her. My Mandarin isn't good enough to do actual jokes with her. But for her, it's like I'm entertaining in different ways, like through song or dance or like exercise or painting, other forms of art. Yeah. I think it would be too painful for me to also do jokes with my mom as the same service that I do for when I'm performing in front of an audience. Does that make sense? It would.
Yeah, of course.
You don't shit where you, what is it? You don't shit where you eat?
You don't shit where you eat.
Is
I think
it
a lot
eat
of people,
or sleep?
I think I've always heard eat.
Okay, you don't shit where
also,
you eat.
Also, I wouldn't shit in either place if you can avoid it.
Just, I don't, yeah, no, because it would suck if I do jokes. The jokes that work for an audience don't work on my mom. That would be devastating, extra devastating. My mom is just like, does not find it funny. No, I'm doing other art forms with her.
Mom is heckling you in your jokes.
Yeah, I'm like, no, I don't need
boo.
This. I'm like, I don't need this. No. With you, I just sing.
You've described like sort of doing things that help your mom feel better. Are there times when you're with your mom or like that you've been going through this sort of journey with her through schizophrenia and OCD and depression that have been joyful and or like funny to you? I think in a lot of situations like this, people sort of assume it's just like a straight black mark in time from the beginning to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there are any times in there where you like have found laughter or joy.
Yeah, for sure. So my mom knows that sometimes her paranoia is, you know, like it, because it gets repetitive that she is annoying, you know, people, mm-hmm. annoying us, you know, and she takes note. She just can't help it. It's her neuroses. It's in there, you know. I have to say this thing. It's bothering me, you know. One of her paranoias, one of her hallucinations / paranoias, one of her things is like she doesn't trust Chinese people, anyone of Chinese descent, which is very hard because she lives in a very Chinese neighborhood of Los Angeles. So all the doctors, all the bank tellers, all the cashiers, everyone's, you know, Chinese. And I forget what it was. My mom's really good at callbacks. She's actually a pretty great, like, comedian with words when she's able to like focus and she's in the conversation with you. She like made a joke one time where it was like a callback to like her paranoia of Chinese people. And it was like this thing where like my husband was laughing, like it was so unexpected. She has moments like that that really like make everything seem so not dire, you know. And other moments, you know, where we have each other's back in like a weird parasite family sick type of way, you know. Maybe where we're like stealing food from the buffets and, you know, stuff like that that we just do and laugh about and don't care. And, you know, my husband will sometimes like feed into her paranoias too. Like, but yes, there's fun moments.
Does your mother live with you now? Or she live with your grandmother? Or where is your mother?
My mom and grandma live with each other and they're like 20 minutes away from us.
Gotcha. And does your mom need, like, can your grandmother take care of her? Or does there like someone else who, or because your mom's self-sufficient in spite of her diagnoses?
Yeah, my grandma sort of takes care of her. And so that's why I'm trying to do the service industry job that is stand-up comedy and, you know, make enough money so that we can have caretakers come by, or maybe buy like a compound situation where my mom and grandma can live in a back house somehow. Cause you know, I still want my marriage to work out. So I can't just quite super move them in. You know, it's not good for my husband's health. Cause the other wild thing, the other Disney princess-y type thing about me is that my husband's mom's also got schizophrenia. And so,
no way.
Yeah. Woo.
And that.
Yeah, boy. Yeah. We don't believe in God.
How did you find out that you both had schizophrenic mothers?
We found out like by chance on like our third date with each other. There was this, we were having drinks like in a patio situation. And there was an unhoused person who is sort of like talking to themselves, and we both knew how to deal with it. And then I was like, how'd you know? You dealt with that really well. Like, you know, we were like, oh, just, you know, like we knew not to like make eye contact. And if we did, you know, you become a part of their world. So, you know, you just have to be non-threatening and sort of talk to them in a way that might not add to the paranoias, you know what I mean? Because you might be part of their paranoias at that time, or exactly the thing they're fearing, whatever. It's this wild thing, right? And we were both on it and knew exactly what we were talking about. And that's when, yeah. And he was like, oh, my mom has this thing. I don't know if you've heard of it, schizophrenia. And I was like, what? My mom too. And we had the craziest sex ever that night. We were like, what? Oh my God. We were like taking our clothes off. We deserve this, you know? Yeah. So that's how we found out. Yeah. My grandma takes care of her right now, but we're trying to make it so that it can be like a community thing, family community situation.
How much does your relationship with your mother factor into your comedy? Like, how much do you draw from it in your act, or do you like try and stay away from it? Or
yeah, I truly didn't talk about it for a long time until, and then the pandemic hit, and then I went insular. We all did. We all went, you know, we all started thinking about, you know, about everything more or not, you know. But yeah, I started trying to write about my mom more during the pandemic, and so with my latest hour, I do talk about her. And it's actually like a big part of the inspiration for how we deal with the conflict in the hour. My husband and I had an intruder come to our house 3 times in the same day. And we realized that our moms actually know best with how to deal with something like this. And I won't like really give it away, but yeah, it's kind of an homage to sort of people who thought like, growing up, you know, we were weirdos, or, you know, all the things that made us freaks, those are actually your superpowers, you know, and it's an homage to our moms.
While you're working on something like that, how conscious are you of making sure you like represent your mom in a particular way? I feel like when I make jokes about my family, a lot of it has been, you know, lovingly shitting on them. Mm-hmm. And like the show that I'm working on is about my son who died, right? So like whenever I talk about him, I'm always conscious of like, you know, this person isn't going to get to speak here. Like, you know, he has nothing to say in the show except what I say about him. Mm-hmm. So I'm very I'm more cautious about anything I say about him than I am about anything else that I say in my life.
For sure, yeah.
And do you feel that way when you're talking about your mom or not?
Yeah. I mostly talk about my feelings surrounding the issues that concern her. Whoa, I've never used those words in a sentence before. Issues that concern her. Surrounding, like, her circumstances, you know? I don't...
Yeah.
Because we don't have, like, hang times that, you know, like, it was so hard for me to just even describe to you, like, the fun times we have. Because our conversations aren't like the typical mom-daughter. It would take so much explaining. That's sort of like, I think, the antithesis of stand-up comedy. I don't really go like, oh, she said this one time or she said this one time. I don't have to worry as much as maybe if you had a lot of hang time with the person you're talking about.
What you're describing specifically in terms of like how those conversations go with your mother, like there's a group of people, your husband included, mm-hmm. probably, who would understand it, right? If you like started to talk to them because they have an experience that's very similar, mm-hmm. like he would latch on to the details and you almost wouldn't need to keep explaining it. It's similar, I think, in like the sort of more quote unquote traditional grief world, mm-hmm. where like, you know, I've had this loss in my life mm-hmm. and trying to explain it to people is very difficult.
Right.
Unless they get it, and then it's so easy. Then it's like, you know, this, this, and this, and they're like, oh my God, of course.
Yeah, yeah. But I think people will always get grief, you know? People will always get the heart of it, even if it's something that never happened to them, because losing someone really important to you is something that we can all, you know, relate to. And I think as long as, like, the heart of it is... like that you are coming at from it from a loving place, obviously. I feel like, you know, you can do all the jokes because that's your person. That's your loved one, you know?
Yeah.
Unless you're like, I hated them and I don't know. I don't know.
Which I think some people do. Also, that's
true,
I'm sure,
and that's
thing.
True, and that's
people
honest
have the people
truth.
Who died, and it's like that sucked. I'm glad that they died. I'm sure that's a thing that happens.
No, that's so true. So yeah, it doesn't. I think everything's on the table. Like everything's on the table.
Let's go. I think this is it. I think we did it.
We did it. Yeah.
I think we finished the podcast.
Sorry, this wasn't. You know, I wasn't serving punchlines every minute.
No, this is not a serving punchline
oh,
podcast.
Oops. Okay.
You want to go back? We can start over and do it sadder if you want.
No.
This was fantastic. I appreciate you doing this. It was going to be, it's the kind of thing that people who have been listening to the podcast really have been asking for. So I appreciate having you here. This was A Good Cry with Atsuko Okatsuka. I said your last name incorrectly.
No, you didn't. Oh, you right? crushed it.
Oh, fuck.
You crushed
Shouldn't
it,
have stopped myself.
Mikael. Mikael.
Fuck, God damn it. Thanks for listening. I hope it helps. A Good Cry is brought to you by Radio Point and HeadGum, with executive producers Alex Bach. I'm talking Sabrina Fonfetter and Daniel Powell. Of course, Richard Corson, and don't you forget Houston Snyder. It is also produced by V. Abigail Lowenthal and mixed and edited by the one and only Ian Sorrentino.
That was a HeadGum podcast.